Hello, and welcome back to the Test Drive Podcast, brought to you by Sport Car USA. I'm your host, Lee Baudette. Hi, everybody. Lee Baudette, your host of Test Drive and our Test Drive podcast. As a matter of fact, today we're going to be releasing Test Drive podcast number 45. We thought it'd be kind of fun to take a look back at the previous 44 Test Drive podcasts and play various clips of some of the great guests that we've had, and we've had a bunch. So we hope you enjoy it. Every Friday at 5 o'clock, we release these Test Drive podcasts. So here it is, Test Drive podcast number 45. I'm Lee Baudette with Test Drive, saying so long for now.
I can list off the cars he owned over the years, you know, his 66 Chevelle, 68 Buick Grand Sport, 70 Hearse Olds, you know, just the cars that he grew up with, the pictures, the stories of, he grew up in upstate New York, you know, where the roads were wide open and there were cops few and far between. So, tell all these great stories. And, you know, we grew up going to car shows and dreaming and wishing and hoping, you know, someday we'd have our own. And, I actually grew up racing motocross and derby, so we spent a lot of our weekends going across state racing dirt bikes. And when I got to be 13 years old, it was kind of the crest of youth racing into adult racing, and where you'd go from, you know, the 80cc class to the 125 at the time, back when they were racing two strokes. Everything's gone four stroke in that sport, but you know, it got a lot more expensive. I remember my parents and I, and you know, had a few injuries and concussions, and they're like, you know, really, how much longer do you want to stay in dirt bike racing? And I came up with a great compromise that my dad immediately jumped onto. And I said, I tell you what, if we restore an old muscle car together, I'll get out of motocross. And so my dad and I spent a summer looking for cars, and we found this heap of junk up in Jeffersonville, Vermont. We paid $3,200 for it. Had no motor, no transmission, just a rolling chassis and a body. And it was a 1970 Chevelle. And, you know, we, at that point, we embarked on a 5-year restoration that really got it up and running by, it was actually just shortly after my 17th birthday that we got that thing on the road, and we've had it on the road the 15 years since.
If you've listened to these podcasts that we've been doing on a weekly basis, you will probably remember that the Chevelle is one of my favorite of all-time cars. I mean, I'm a big Mustang guy, but I always loved the Chevelle, the Oldsmobile 42s out there. Tell us the steps that along the way got you to where you are today with that Chevelle.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We learned a lot on that project. You know, the first year was just tearing out an old interior, really getting it down to bare metal, and then kind of planning what we were going to do for a build. And, you know, you start it, you know, really building it from the frame up, and it's, you know, suspension, brakes, things that people don't realize. You know, you obviously got to put a drivetrain in it, get the, you know, body, throw an interior in, and each part took a while. I mean, if you had the money, you could do it fairly quickly. It's just, you'd save up all summer. I'd work, you know, whatever summer job I could. And, you know, my dad sold real estate part-time at the time, and whatever he'd earn for commissions, we'd put into the car. And so, you know, one year we'd save up and we'd buy the suspension and the brakes, but you know, that was $6,500 or $7,000. And so then you'd save up for another year and then spend it all in one fell swoop. But, you know, it was, you know, the work kind of centered all around that. We would go around to car shows, check things out, look for what we wanted to do. Obviously, we were lucky we had a VIN number that was a Chevelle SS. And so while it's not numbers matching now, we wanted to build it to SS spec. So we put a 454 with LS6. Island Racing built us a beautiful motor that still runs great. And we're running close to 500 horsepower, almost 600 foot-pounds of torque. So we have a lot of fun with it, but
you know, you learn what the car can perform like so that you can relay that to the customer. So when I get back from these trainings, I'm amped up. I'm ready to go. And, you know, that's the easiest time to sell a sports car is when you come back from training because you're all, knowledge is fresh. Right. And you know that. And you can feel what 455 horsepower in a Camaro feels like. And, you know, 490 in a Chevrolet Corvette C8. So it's been a great experience and certainly a lot of fun.
Yeah. Sounds like we should do a test drive episode with one of these trainings. Sounds like it'd be a lot of fun for sure.
It would be.
So let's break it down a little bit. Camaro, we'll start with the Camaro. What was that like for you to go to the track and test out the Camaro? What year was it?
Yeah. So this was in 20... 2019, I believe, just before the pandemic hit. Once the pandemic hit, there was a couple of years of no training. Right. But in 2019, we got to test drive the SS on the track. They were almost all SSs. There was a couple 1SSs mixed in there. And they basically videotaped you in the car so you could see what you look like, how many Gs you were doing around corners. Nice. It was basically like an indie track, so you weren't just going in a normal circle. You were, you know, cutting in and out of turns. It was a lot of fun. And they make sure you know top to bottom what the car is, how it compares to the competition, Mustangs, any car that is in the same line. And then they get into you and give you the driver experience where you get to drive them and put them to the test. And the pro driver that's in front of you leading, he'll go as fast as you can go, basically. So if you keep up with him, he's on the foot.
So you didn't have anybody sitting right beside you?
Nope.
You had the car to yourself?
Car was all to myself. Nice. Yeah, nice. It was pretty awesome. And then once you get done with the SS division, they actually bring in a hot lap and a ZL1 Camaro. Ooh. So you can feel what that 650 horse feels like. And that was spectacular to have a pro driver. So I was in the passenger seat. Pro driver was driving me, and it's insane.
What kind of rules do they lay down? I mean, it seems to me like whenever I go to these trainings, and I've only been to a couple, no Corvettes or Camaros, but there's always one or two of the quote-unquote drivers, people such as yourself, that really don't obey the law.
Yeah.
They don't obey the rules, I should say. Do they lay down the law, so to speak, and say, hey, you know, you can only go so fast, or no burnouts, things like that?
I mean, it's kind of just respect to not do a burnout.
Right.
But you're basically the pro driver will say, if you can keep up with me, we'll keep going. So, I mean, we were doing 130 into turns.
Whoa.
So you're cooking high speeds.
Is it a bank track?
Yep. Yep.
Nice.
Bank track, but indie-like. So you kind of cut over it's almost like a checkered flag in turn. And just a lot of fun.
How much control did you feel that you had? Did you feel in total control of that vehicle?
Total control. So when those cars, and specifically are in, I'm blanking on it now. When they're in traction control, when they're in traction control, you have full control because there's no slip because it's always looking for traction.
Yeah.
So you can pretty much lay on the gas pedal and give it almost as much as you can. And the car's just going to know how to handle. When you get in the car, they're already in track mode. They ask you not to do it manual paddle shift, but you always find yourself trying it out just because.
Yeah. And I know whenever I bought a sport car and it has traction control, I've been told do not take that off unless you're on the track. And you're saying it was still on when you were on the track. Did anybody ever take the traction control off?
Or? I'm sure they did, but you never really stopped. Like, once you went, you were going around the track until you were done.
Okay.
You know, you do like three laps, I think, and you're done. But when that traction control's on, you can really lay into the car, and it won't spin out on you.
Yeah, your accent's not going to come up and say hello.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So that's the Camaro. You had a big win in Atlanta. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was great. We had a pretty decent car, honestly. And the start of the race, we weren't as good as we wanted to be, and ultimately had a pit penalty. We had our pit coach actually had both his hands down on the hot side of pit road, which is illegal, a no-no. So they caught us on that, and they said, "Hey, you got a pit penalty." So that put us in the back. Then we got some contact and spun out, tore up the car a little bit, but one of those instances where I was able to fix it. And we believed it was going to be a rain shortened race. Looking at the radar, we were pretty confident of that. So we were able to make a pretty decent pit call and stay out there. And then the car was good enough to hold off those guys until the rain came, essentially. So it worked out. You know, it was great to be in that position, and you have to be there to get those wins. So that was a testament to our whole team.
And people don't realize always that it's not just about raw power and, you know, pedal to the metal. It's a strategic thing too, like any other sport where, you know, like you were saying, like you decided not to pit at certain times and just try and, hope the tires hold or you have enough gas or, you know, those sort of things. So
Yeah, of course. Like, yeah, because in that instance, you know, our strategy wouldn't have worked if the race had have gone in the entirety.
Right.
You know, we would have had to pit again, and other guys may not have. Right. So
kind of taking that gamble.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the good thing right now for us, you know, with having three wins prior to that race, we're able to take that gamble. Because if it doesn't work out, it doesn't really hurt us that bad. But if it does work out, then we win, you know,
and it just pushes
not everybody's in that position.
This show that you are the head of, if you will, the Vermont Antique and Classic Car Meet, has been around for 66 years.
Mm-hmm. Certainly predates me.
That's a long time.
Yes, it has. I think they started out having it at one of the ski areas originally in the parking lot.
Yeah.
It's grown in size. I think it is. I know of no other car show in New England of this anywhere near that size. As I said, people, we have members who come from all over the country, in fact, outside the country, and certainly people who come to the show, bring their cars, are from all over, and it's the event.
The cars have to be at least, what, 20 or 25 years old?
We are kind of finding our way on that. We have got new, you know, we have judging classes. And we've got classes now that are opening up to, well, I don't have the stuff in front of me, but where you can allow more modern cars or customized cars and see if there's big participation, good. If not, we'll try something else. So we're not trying to be restricted to really old cars.
Right.
However, we do want to have antique cars there because I think that's what the attraction is.
Right. People come from all around, all over the country, really, to check out this show. How many cars are we talking about, and how many spectators?
Spectator numbers, I don't have any handle on at all. Car numbers are anywhere from 200 to 300.
Right.
And, of course, cars are only maybe half of what's going on. The other half is the flea market.
Oh, yeah.
And there we've got, I think, available 500 flea market spaces. Most of them get taken. The last time I was at a meeting, I think like two-thirds of them have already been taken. And frankly, that is probably as big a source of revenue to the club as any of the rest of the show.
People that have classic cars and antique cars, they're looking for parts.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And memorabilia.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there.
Yes, it's all there. Yep.
So there must be some great stories to tell about throughout the years with the Street Rodders. Is there any one or two that really just sticks out as far as maybe how the car came about, where the person found it, how much work they had to do on it? Anything like that stick out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's always some. I mean, you know, every now and then you'll run into – I have a guy out in Bakersfield, California, and that is all, one of my events that I also do out there. His dad bought the car. He gave them to him when he was 17 years old, and he still has it.
Nice.
Hasn't changed it. Hasn't done anything other than maybe put some new tires on it. Otherwise, it's still all original, you know. And he brings it to our events because he likes cars. He realizes it's an antique. It's all original. It's not the thing. But he'll tell you the stories. I mean, he knows everything about that car inside and out. Mm-hmm. I mean, he grew up in that car, and it's just, it's still, it's neat. It's not really my cup of tea. I'm a hot rod guy. I like a modified.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's neat in its own way. I do know that one of the TV stations came out to Essex Junction last year, and they ended up doing a story, same kind of thing. They found a guy that knew all about the car. It was like his dad's car and the whole thing, and they carried on down through the things. It's not uncommon to have a third generation now that it was grandpa's car, got passed to dad, now it's grandson's car.
Yeah, it's all about the stories. I mean, when you talk about older vehicles, it's about the story, and some of them are short and sweet. Others, as you just mentioned, have a lot of history to it and a lot of people involved.
Like to backtrack a little bit, and Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? We know your nickname is Jono. That's about all we know right now.
Yeah, so I've been with Hemmings for about the last 4 years. Started consulting with Hemmings in 2019. really started with an understanding of, you know, the online auction space. My background is in digital product development. I was with Hemmings' parent company before that. And, you know, we saw a need in the rise of online auctions and kind of the change in how people were buying and selling cars online. The opportunity for Hemmings to diversify, you know, beyond just kind of your traditional classified, which we, you know, still run that business. But what I think is unique about Hemmings is we run three distinct marketplaces now. So we have our classifieds, both in print and online. We have a buy now, make offer marketplace, and then we have our live online auctions. So really we've harnessed this amazing brand that's been built over the last 70 years on a reputation of customer service and trust. And we've started to really flex our muscle in the digital marketplace space and really seen tremendous gains for Hemmings. You know, we'll do almost 40 million people will visit Hemmings.com this year. So seen really tremendous growth for the online property and the print product remains strong. But that's me from the business side. You might have been asking a little bit more about why I love cars and why I'm here and loving to talk about collector cars. Is that right, Lee?
That was my second question, Jono. I wanted to know, when did you get the car bug? Is it something that was you grew up with or later in life?
Yeah, I have been really fortunate, kind of in the situation I grew up with here in Charlotte, North Carolina. My parents had a piece of property outside of town, about 50 acres. And my favorite thing in the world to do is wake up, you know, if I wasn't at preschool, you know, when I was 4 and 5 years old, was running out to the barn. I wanted to climb on the tractor, work on the tractor, get in the John Deere Gator, anything with the motor, dirt bikes. You know, I started out with a little 50cc Honda, you know, kind of little trail bike, and my love of everything automotive kind of grew from there and got out of two wheels into four wheels. And I just love anything that has an engine. I still love going out there. They still have the property. I still love starting up the tractors and moving things around. But my first automotive memory was when I was 4, climbing myself up into my parents' Jeep Grand Wagoneer. And I just thought, I still think that's one of the coolest cars ever made. You know, it's gold with the faux wood paneling. It's got a corduroy burgundy interior, and I can literally picture it in my head trying to climb up in it. And it's like a monster truck to me at the time. I just think it's the coolest thing in the world. And that's my first car memory. Outside of riding around, you know, the backseat that faced the wrong way, you know,
yeah,
the
oncoming
traffic in my in my mom's Buick Regal station wagon back then, you know.
So that's
when my love of cars started. My grandfather loved hot rods, and we shared that passion together. I learned how to drive in his 1954 Chevy Bel Air. That was what I used to drive around with my learner's permit with him on Saturdays, cruising the country roads outside of Charlotte when Charlotte still had country roads. Now it's a behemoth city and continues to grow. But I love it. I still love it. I'm feel like probably like you guys do. I found a cheat code in life where I get to talk about cars and work with cars, really cool cars, every single day, and it makes it not feel like work.
What the big three, the Detroit auto manufacturers, did is rather than having full product lines through their brand for people to graduate through, what they did was they used the brand names as their differentiators. So when you were starting out, you would have a Ford. And then when you got the career job and you were having the household and stuff like that, you would graduate to a Mercury or you would graduate from a Chevy to a Buick or from a Pontiac into a Chevy into a Buick and so on.
Yeah.
And then once you had really made it, if you were really successful, that's when you would get the Cadillac or you get the Lincoln or you get the and so on. And so like they use the brands as the statuses and then the trim levels of the cars within the brands to show like who really belonged, as it were. So it was a very much a status symbol type thing to have a particular brand. As we've moved into the modern era for scale of economy in terms of the manufacturing process, they've gone to making a lot of the same cars essentially between the different brands. And so when you look at a Buick with a comparable model Chevrolet, at, you know, the Chevrolet at the high tier versus like a second from the top on the Buick, like they're essentially the same car. So
right.
A lot of these manufacturers, like you look at GM, they did away with their Pontiac line. You look at Ford, they did away with the Mercury line. And so it's because they found that they were just competing with themselves for their own sales.
Right.
And so now they have, like, everybody typically has their core line, and then they have their luxury line.
Right. And there's just two.
Yeah, there's just tiers. Two. Yeah. And with the one exception, of course, being GM, because they still have Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, and GMC. Right. Where GMC has kind of become that mid luxury tier for them that they've stuck with. Chevrolet kind of the entry level one.
Right.
But then Buick is not, like, on the US side, it's kind of the odd duck. You're like, I don't know necessarily how this fits, but it's because it is such a massive success overseas for whatever reason, especially in the Chinese market. Like the Buick line is just massive.
How did you develop your passion for cars, John? Was it a little boy growing up, or?
Well, you know, I've always been, my dad was a mechanic, and, you know, moved up through the ranks. I've worked as a beer truck mechanic, golf cars. I've done golf cars in high school and so on. And as I said, you know, the mechanical work, like a Selectric typewriter, is a purely mechanical machine. And, you know, you guys have probably never seen one apart, but they are fantastic. It's really impressive what they do. But then somehow things change where I'm very mechanical. I like hands-on. I went into the semiconductor world where I guess you become an Imagineer because you can't see anything. You have to have a scanning electron microscope. You have to really imagine what's going on. And I spent 40 years as an Imagineer. But all the time, I've still had my mechanical instincts. I do all of my own work, you know, on the cars, on the house, pretty much everything. Not afraid to take the challenge on and also, you know, go ask for help when needed.